There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan. I'm the author of the non-fiction books How to Be a Grown-Up and The Sisterhood. And if you're a regular listener, you might know that my very first novel, Insatiable, is coming in February. I know quite a few of you have pre-ordered it. Thank you so much. I wish I could buy you all a bottle of champagne and a spare kidney. If you're new to the podcast, Insatiable is a novel I have written for every woman who has ever felt frightened of her own appetite and who has been terrified of telling the world what she wants, but even more terrified of what might happen to her if she doesn't try. The people who have read it assure me that it's funny, filthy, heartbreaking in places, but ultimately uplifting. And if you're a Your Book listener, you can pre-order an exclusive signed hardback from Waterstones as a link in the show notes. Now to this week's guest. She's someone I've admired for a long time. She's courageous. She's open about the challenges of balancing physical and mental toughness and vulnerability. She's got an enormous platform and she consistently uses it to champion the issues that are important to her. And she has just written a brilliant book, Not the Type, about all these things. Camilla Thurlow is an author and a humanitarian worker. She's worked with the landmine clearing charity The Halo Trust as an explosive ordnance disposal expert. And you may also know her from the 2017 series of Love Island and fallen in love with her when she started a discussion about feminism on primetime TV. Camilla and I talked about the power of memoirs, the pleasure of building your bookshelves, and the problems we all face when we curate an extensive digital footprint. I was wondering, first of all, about what you were doing in terms of reading over the lockdown. And when you were writing, was it something that you found comforting and reassuring? Because I also know some people loved escaping into books and some people found it really difficult to focus when the news is just so scary and constant.
Yeah, I wasn't great at reading over lockdown, being completely honest. And I did a fair amount of kind of buying books and not getting round to reading them, but thinking that I would. I was like, I've got all this time, I'll read and read, and I definitely didn't.
Is there anything here that you've not read yet, but you're excited about reading?
Actually, this, but this was lent to me by my sister, David Sedaris, Me Talk Pretty One Day. My little sister just lent me that. I've been wanting to read some of his work for a while, so she said she recommended that one. We quite often do little book swaps, me and my younger sister. So I lent her, I think, Lisa Didio, Three Women.
We just had her on.
Did you?
Yes.
I love her. I really love her. And a few other bits and pieces. But my younger sister reads faster than I do, so sometimes we have a slight imbalance going on where she gets things back to me and I'm forever hoarding her books here.
And are you sort of saying, yes, of course, I'm reading it right now, it's very good.
Exactly.
And let me have a look at that, Sedaris, because I'm trying to... Is it all right if I pick it up?
Yeah, to help yourself. Can we
grab them? I've brought some spray. I can disinfect this. I'm trying to remember which ones, because I always get this confused with... Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. Things that I didn't think would ever make me laugh, David Sedaris can make me laugh at.
That's what everyone keeps telling me. So I'd said to my younger sister, I want to read something, but I want something funny. I don't know why. I was going through that patch where I couldn't really couldn't really face even a novel that was quite immersive in its content. But if it had anything emotional in, I was like, I don't think I'm going to be able to get through it. And so that's what she said. She said that David Sedaris was the one to read. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to starting that. The last couple of weeks have been slightly busy. So I haven't got underway with it. But that's probably next on my list. And I think will be quite a nice escape. I'm definitely excited to read it, which is quite nice. You know how sometimes you'll put a book on your shelf and be like, oof, that's going to be a real challenge. You know when someone tells you actually about a TV series, they'll go, it's great, but you have to just get through the first episode.
Yes. Or the first three series.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas I think that's just going to be from the word go.
Have you read Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reid?
Yes, I have. Yes. I really am such a fan. But I really enjoyed that. But I think I need to read it again. I think it's one of those things where when you see something go on the book a long list, you wonder, did I get everything out of that I was meant to? Because I read for enjoyment. Sometimes I'll come away and I'll be like, oh, yes, I just so loved that book and it was really interesting. But then I've maybe missed some of the beauty of the writing. So this is my friend's book, The Doll Factory by Elizabeth McNeil. And I went to school with her, so I know her like so well. And the book is just so beautifully written, so detailed, the amount of research it must have taken to do it, that when I read it, I had this different appreciation for it because I knew she must have done all that, which I sort of forget when I read other books. I don't think about how much has gone into, you know, the research side or the structural side or building the world up. I just read it and think someone sat down and wrote that quite easily, but it's not as easy.
I often think that the easier to read a book is, the harder that writer has worked.
I so agree. I think that's why, see, something like Alain de Botton or even actually Elizabeth Day, the genius is all happening at their end. Mm. So they do all the hard work of kind of distilling really complicated feelings and kind of aspects of the human condition into these sentences, paragraphs, pages that you don't have to reread. They're not complicated. You get to the end of a page and you're like, yes, I've really learned something. And you just feel so clever when you're doing it. You're like, oh, I've just understood really complicated things so easily. And that's because of what they do as opposed to what you have to do as a reader.
I suppose it's like being a really talented architect, isn't it? Yes. And you look at a beautiful building and you think that is poetry and that makes sense. Yes. And everything fits that. And of course they did it like that because there's no other way. And yes, I think that's when the writing really flows.
Yes, exactly.
But tell me about the Doll Factory, because I don't know the story. It's the most beautiful edition.
Isn't
it's got really gorgeous
endpapers.
And beautiful inscription.
This one. Yeah, I have a few different... In fact, I've got them like a stack of them down here. But I should give you like the proper blurb and do her justice. It kind of explores these quite dark... It's sort of, I would call it gothic, and I'm hoping that she's not going to be offended because I've called it that. But it's basically follows Iris, who works in a doll factory originally, painting the faces of dolls. And that's interwoven with another story of Silas, who's a taxidermist. And so their stories are kind of interconnected, and it's all set in Victorian London, and it's all about kind of art from that time, and sort of he's quite obsessive, he's like an obsessive character, and it has quite a gripping, dark ending. But I would highly recommend it.
Well, I am sold. I feel as though if one was the sort of person who loves Jessie Burton, which I do,
yes,
that's the sort of book that you would like.
Exactly. So the muse is actually not too far along from her, but she, yes, it's exactly that style of book, and it must take so much research to understand that time, and she references very specific events that genuinely did happen. So how she managed to structure her story, which was fiction, into a non-fiction time period, I always think is very impressive.
To be a brilliant writer and an historian, I hate her already.
Yeah. But she's always been that kind of person. She's like incredibly detail orientated. And she really, like, she's quite an inspiration to me because she had a very, I would say, kind of the, she's incredibly intelligent, and she went through university and everything and did exceptionally well, and then dropped into one of those consultancy careers that kind of quite a few of the people I know ended up doing. And then decided and realised it wasn't right, became a potter. And then gets up at 5 a.m. and goes to bed very late to write novels. And yeah, and then had this incredible debut novel. And sort of everyone went, oh my gosh, what an overnight success. And of course, all of us who know her have seen years and years of very, very hard work, which I think is true for so many writers.
It's that it's been much more of a 5 a.m. success, yes, 5 a.m. yes, every day, yeah, for years.
Yeah, and a lot of ripped up pieces of paper and screaming at laptop screens than anyone ever realises.
There's a detail in your book that I love that I wanted to ask you about. You talk about seeing Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus on the bookcase. And I was thinking about how books are such sort of big visual prompts, especially when you're little and you just sort of absorb an image or an idea, even if you don't know what's kind of under the covers. Can you, are there any other books that had a big effect on you formatively, whether they were books that you just saw, or can you remember the first book that you read that felt like something you'd chosen to read that didn't come from a parent or teacher?
I was really obsessed with, I don't know if it was called Nurse Potter, but you know the Osborne books, and Nurse Potter was like one of them. So really, this is really young, but I like completely obsessed with that and dressed up as a nurse for an entire year of my life. And I was quite like that when I was young, like I picked things up from the world around me. And then when I was sort of like mid, maybe 7 or 8, I was obsessed with kind of Famous Five, Secret Seven. And obviously there's George in The Famous Five who cuts off all her, has very short hair and is quite a tomboy. And I made my brother cut off all my hair, and that was, you know, and I asked people to call me by a boy's name. And I had this thing where I really wanted to be a tomboy for a long time.
What was your other identity? Was it a version of Camilla or was it completely?
No, it wasn't really. Well, I suppose it probably was, actually. I don't really know, but I was quite, because I was influenced by the book so heavily, it was that I wanted to be a tomboy who went and solved mysteries, and that became my persona. I picked it up from what I'd read.
So I don't know if you agree with this or not, but it feels as though that had quite an impact on what you then went on to do, to be that sort of fearless and having adventures and be in the centre. I know, and another thing that I thought was so interesting about your book is that the contrast and contradiction, I think it's something we all have, that, you know, we want to be good and follow the rules and be approved of and seek safety, but at the same time that you have put yourself in these thrilling and challenging situations.
I do think some of that was picked up from what I read, actually. Maybe not quite as young as, like, 7, but I was obsessed with, and I still have a few of them up here, things like this is the story of Tim Hetherington, who was a war photographer who was killed in Libya, so Here I Am, and Paul Conroy, who was Marie Colvin's photographer that travelled with her, and this is actually all about that, you know, their final few days under the wire. And those were the books that I really gravitated towards, and I couldn't quite understand why, because I had this fascination with, I guess, conflict, but I had no desire to be part of conflict. Like, I couldn't reconcile these two ideas, that I found those books to be the most interesting. Sebastian Junger's Tribe is there as well, and again, those were all just fascinating to me, but that wasn't what necessarily appealed to me. And I quickly realised that, actually, to be honest, it's probably more, it's more the effect that conflict has for those who are within it and for those who are affected by it. And that was something that I wanted to understand more and try and be a part of, I guess, reconstruction efforts. But equally, I think there's a really complicated thing with conflict where it has a quite devastating effect often on the people who are even part of the action. And that was something that kind of stuck with me. And the charity that I went to work for, actually, obviously some of the people who worked there were ex-military. And so it kind of fascinated me that they now worked so hard on removing explosive remnants of war. And how does that trajectory happen? I think it's a tricky one, because it's not that I followed the paths of the people that I read about and admired, because they had such different paths to the one I had. But I was able to glean something from that that gave me an understanding of what maybe interested me or where I thought I could be useful.
Because I suppose the immediate aftermath of war and conflict, it's all of the extremes of humans, I suppose. And as you say, you know, what it's like to be with people who are having to, you know, endure the consequences and rebuild a life, and that it's actually very constructive, I suppose, to bring structure in the sort of the wake of devastation.
Yeah, and I think there's a another person there whose book I absolutely love is Dr. David Knott, War Doctor, and so he would go to places on his leave time from working in the NHS here to help to help those civilians who were being affected. So he went to some really tricky areas, and he still works very closely with those who are being injured and killed around Syria. And so actually the reason I keep this copy, and it's very special to me, is I had already bought his book, but then I volunteered at an event that he spoke at. And he is just this very, I would say, mild-mannered, lovely man, maybe like the last person you'd expect, this from our the way we stereotype people who we associate to go into that area. He is in every way kind of calm and just so lovely, and he's gone to these extremely dangerous places and done extremely difficult things. And you start to realize like our understanding of who will do things or who is capable of taking on that role is slightly warped by maybe the movies that we see and the TV programs that we watch that talk about conflict in this way of being quite, I guess, heroic sometimes. And often it's like the big muscular man, this type that we associate. And actually within conflict, there's obviously the hundreds of men, women and children who are desperately, terribly affected by it, who are just trying to go about their ordinary lives. But there's also equally many people who are going into that situation to try and help, who we don't always see. We don't see that storyline. And so it's just important to me that those kind of stories, I guess, are told, because they are a huge part of what puts everything back on the right track.
Because I suppose to do it well and do it effectively, you can't come in with an ego. You have to be someone who, I suppose, it's, you know, responding, not reacting, isn't it?
That's exactly what it is. It can't be that you're going in with some sense of being heroic. That's another problem, is when people go in with that idea, and actually I touch on this in the book as well, that they're doing something to help.
Yeah.
They're much less likely to respond when someone says, yes, we do want you to help, but can you help us like this? Because this is actually what we need. Instead, you kind of get this lopsided structure where it's like, well, we're helping, so what we say goes.
Yeah.
And that's not helpful at all to anyone. And it's not respectful either. And it doesn't aid anyone, really. So it's just really important. And that is the thing. You know, you have someone like David Knott, who went in because of something that he believed in and a skill that he knew he had that he could help, and then did what was asked, what people were asking him to do, and still does. I mean, still really is so instrumental in raising awareness of how people are affected by conflict. So perhaps I was reading things that were related to my ultimate career path, but they didn't necessarily lead me in a direct route there. They sort of circled round things and then finally it kind of clicked into place.
I do think that things, you know, just sort of come to us at times and they're in bits of our brain and we, you know, they don't, it's not necessarily something logical or joined up, but it's a slow, slow revealing over time.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that's why it's so important not to see things as mistakes all the time. Like, I feel like, and again, I mentioned this in the book, like your 20s feels like a series of bad decisions. And actually, quite often, you're just making a decision with to the best of your knowledge and the best of your ability at the time. And a year later, you realise maybe you need to move in another direction. And so you do. And that's it. It's all about growth and allowing yourself to change. And books are definitely such a big part of that, because they give you that ability to perhaps look at someone else's experience without necessarily having to take the plunge yourself. Like, I read lots of books where I go, oh, I couldn't do that in a million years, but it's nice to read about.
That's kind of how I feel about War Doctor. I'm like, I want to support your efforts without.
Yeah, yeah.
I have no medical skills. I'm going to, you know, my help wouldn't be helping.
I'm helping
more by reading the book and staying away. But that doesn't make me think of the book I loved that I see on your shelf, Expectation by Anna Hope.
I love that book. I love that book. That's my favourite book that I've read this year.
Really? Wow.
Oh my gosh, and I didn't expect it to, expectation.
Hey.
I didn't realise it was going to be as good as it was. I don't know if it's just something that resonated with me. Maybe I read it at exactly the right moment. You know, that occasionally happens when you read a book and it's like bang on. But I just loved it. I found it so absorbing and really real. And yeah, I came away quite sad that I had to say goodbye to all the people
in it. Oh, I know
that
when you really ache when you get to the last page.
Yeah.
But I've loved hanging out with you all.
But I reread things a lot.
Ah, do you?
Yes.
Me too.
Yeah, I'm quite an anxious person. And I found out the other day, because I rewatch TV programmes a lot as well, it's part of its safety because you already know the ending. So I definitely reread things knowing that I'm going to get to the same place again.
Oh, especially if I've read something where I really love the characters and it's the idea that bad things are happening to them. The first time around it's awful, and the second time, oh, I know they're okay in the end.
Yes, that's very true.
But I thought about Expectation because I was thinking about that idea of mistakes. And I think we all have this a bit in our 20s when you feel as though there is a right way and a wrong way. Yeah. And if something feels uncomfortable or it doesn't quite work out, like, oh, wait, I did it wrong, I made a mistake. And that they're all unwittingly almost looking at each other, or not even looking at each other, but thinking, oh, I should be doing what they're doing, and comparing. I mean, and I don't even think there are many points even where they compare lives. There is just that sense that they've got this idea they should be free, or they should be, you know, having a family. Or...
Yes. But I think that when you're doing something because you think you should be doing it, then when it goes wrong, that feels 10 times worse than if you kind of made that decision for yourself and maybe did something that other people questioned and other people don't understand. That feels horrible, but it's, you can kind of recognize that as being part of the learning experience, whereas when you're doing things because you think you should be and then they all fall apart, which kind of inevitably they will because it's not the right thing for you anyway, that can feel quite crushing. And that's what I just, some of the other characters in the book that you can see them shaping, you know, the three women in it shaping their lives to kind of fit around these other characters. When you're reading it from their perspective, you just suddenly clock some things that they're doing that isn't a result of anything internal, it's all external. And that's harder to spot in real life, but it's worth a try.
I think you're right. I was thinking about Eleanor Oliphant as well, which is a book I loved, and you know, that it's about someone really living in fear and living in a space of like reacting to this awful, awful thing, and then, you know, the happy ending is that she, it sounds so simple to say, she gets to do what she wants, but even being able to find the room to think about what you want, you know, and her slow and gorgeous liberation is so powerful.
I love that book, but I found that really interesting in, you know, how she drinks all weekend. Mm. It made me think of the people sometimes you know who are functioning Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, and who just seem to have their life so sorted, or seem to have a really strong idea of who they are, which I wonder if that's how I would have seen her if I worked in the same office as her. Mm. Maybe I would have thought she was totally set on, you know, maybe I might not have thought she was like me, but I might just have thought she had her own ideas of how she was going to do things.
And those sort of rigid, defensive, inflexible people are often the most vulnerable, and they're just so desperate and protective because they can't show their softness.
Exactly. And so it did really make, that really made me think about the people that I think I know but are actually probably more acquaintances than close friends, how little I see of the difficult aspects of their life and how easy it becomes to kind of just take everything at face value. That was what, I mean, I just had a few people that I suddenly thought about quite differently and worried maybe whether they had sort of got these second lives that I hadn't really thought about before.
I mean, that's such a powerful, powerful thing for a book to do. But, you know, going back to what you were saying about things that sort of feel too immersive. That's, I imagine that being quite an uncomfortable thing to sit with.
Yes. Yeah, actually, and that is why I read certain books at certain times, because I do find books leak out into my real life. And that's sometimes why I just need something a bit lighter and a bit funnier. Or I do that thing sometimes of reading non-fiction alongside fiction to kind of have one as an escape and one as reality, I guess.
You've got a chaser. Yeah. Sort of sentient.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly like having a drink chaser. Something just to refresh my palate before I go to sleep. I am definitely very responsive to what I read and what I watch and what I see, and that's why I'm quite cautious with how much I take in online as well, because it shapes and it changes the way I am in day-to-day life. And that's why I always take fun light paperbacks on holiday, because I, if I'm going to go somewhere and try and have a happy time, if I read something dark, I am myself quite dark.
Well, let's assume you're going on a holiday. I'm magically granting you 2 weeks somewhere quiet, you've got sunshine in a pool. What are you packing to read?
I mean,
and you
probably
can reread anything you like. Are you gravitating towards the Ken Follett? They look well thumbed.
Oh my gosh, these are well thumbed, because I love these books. But the reason I love them is because they're actually Jamie's, and they were given to him by his grandma. And Jamie reads no fiction apart from the Ken Follett books and absolutely loves them. And I did take one of these away. I took it, it wasn't on a holiday though, but I took it on a trip abroad, and they are just so brilliant. But how someone writes something of that length and keeps track of all the stories, I will never ever now I've written a non-fiction already structured book which just went in chronological order and realized how hard it was to keep track of that to me is like unbelievable. But yes, I would definitely take something like that away with me and reread. I would love, like, something along here, The Party, Elizabeth Day.
I love The Party. And I was thinking about that as well, being an example of a character where, I can't remember his name, but all the way, his kind of grubby, uncomfortable social climbing.
Yeah.
That I don't think he even really wants what he thinks he wants. And that's what makes it so devastating and sad and painful.
She's so clever at how she writes about people, though. It's because she really understands.
True, I love to have to fail, but I love her fiction.
Yes.
I'm hungry for more.
And actually, I enjoyed this. I read this not that long ago, The Bookish Life of Nina Hill, and I just read it because I quite liked the sound of the blurb.
I don't know that one, but I like the idea of anyone who's got a bookish life. Yeah. By, is that Abby Waxman?
So Nina is like, she's sort of introverted, and she does these quiz nights and things, and it has actually in it, so I really liked how they did this. You know how everyone has these planners nowadays with, like, what they're going to do that day? So, like, each chapter kind of starts with one of those planners. And I wouldn't say it was, like, the most challenging piece of work, but I just really enjoyed it. I found it very easy to read and quite like me.
It's so really, really fun. And it sounds like perhaps a less unhappy Eleanor Oliphant, where you've got a heroine who's very, very rigid in the way she lives her life. And then, to do a spoiler or a hint, according to the blurb on the back, she acquires an enormous surprise family and has to start socialising with them.
Yeah, so that I think that one might even have been one of the ones where Amazon kind of recommends, if you liked Eleanor Oliphant, you might like this.
Are you quite open to those? Or does it depend on the time and the day?
Yeah, it definitely depends on the time of day. I can be quite obtuse, actually, and be a bit like, if you're telling me that I want to read it, then I will. But I do that with everyone, even with friends, when they say sometimes you must read this. I can be quite like, well, must I? Like, and then I'll wait, and then when I read
it. No one's set me homework for 15 years.
But then I'll read them, and I always end up enjoying them, and I'm like, what was I holding out for? There was no reason for that. I don't know why I do it.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
We'll be back to Camilla soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. A Girl Returned by Donatella di Pietranonio. This is the eerily beautiful and devastating story of a 13-year-old girl who suddenly learns that the people she believed to be her parents have adopted her, and they're giving her back to her birth family. This is a fierce, angry, vulnerable, tender book, and it made me gasp. It's an urgent examination of poverty, pretense, wealth, class, and sexuality. It's translated by Anne Goldstein, Elena Ferrante's translator, and while the author's voice is entirely singular, if you loved emotional violence and complexity of the Neapolitan novels, I think you'll adore A Girl Returned. Now, back to Camilla.
And what was the last book that came to you that way?
As a present or as a...
Oh, as a podcast recommendation, I was thinking of. Oh, as a present.
As a podcast recommendation. Probably as a podcast recommendation, I Am Not Your Baby Mother.
Oh, I just read that. I think we're talking to Candice next week.
You are? Crossed.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, I think she's so great. I love following her. I found that so interesting.
It really took me by surprise because I'm not a parent. Yeah. And I thought, oh, I'm not sure I want to read a book about parenting. I'm like, no, this is everything about race and class and living in London. And she's just got such a compelling and lively voice. She writes in a way that you just can't. I just wanted to hang out with her and keep reading.
It's exactly that. And if you've, because I then went to follow her online, and it's that same voice, just a real force of what she wants to say. And that actually isn't as common as it, you know, is it? Should be. It's not you. It's quite rare to find that kind of voice, but I think because of that I found that book quite emotionally difficult to get through, which is bizarre because it's not me who should feel that pain. It's obviously her pain, but I just could not stopping Jamie and reading out chunks of it and explaining the different stories. I think the pram story in it, I just couldn't stop thinking about for days afterwards.
Oh gosh, and the woman opening the door.
It's like you said, I know it is about the path to motherhood, but it's so much more than that. And actually it really reframed partly my understanding of women as nurturers in society and the value that we place on that role and how we respect it. Because I think it's taken me this year, obviously I'm now pregnant, and it's taken me this year, I'm very afraid of emotions, and I had to get to a point where I could, over the last 6 months, entertain these kind of conflicting, really strong feelings all the time. Like, you know, you find out and you're very joyful, but you're also afraid, and you just have to start being able to hold those two things side by side. And I'd spent my whole life running from doing that.
Because I think that if you're an anxious person, because I am deeply, deeply anxious, and you just spend your whole life doing forms of risk assessment and trying to make everything safe. And then when you have a baby, you are opening yourself up to everything, all this glorious, marvellous and amazing. And then, but also everything. And that's so daunting and thrilling.
Yeah, I feel like it's taken me this journey to unlock some of that side of me, but I don't think that's true for nearly all other women. That was the other thing. I was looking around me and suddenly realizing how unconditionally these other women in my life loved so many things, like nurtured so many things, like some with their careers, some with their friendships, and how deep those feelings and difficulties that came with that, they were willing to take on all those emotions to be able to play that role, and that makes them so strong. And yet our understanding of that is so two-dimensional, and really actually has become associated almost solely with motherhood. And that's the only time where you can legitimately be very vulnerable, very compassionate, very empathetic. Yet those things are so important, and that nurturing role is critical to our society in almost every capacity. And yet we don't celebrate it. It's not seen as strong. I do think Elizabeth Day, for me, she's like this person that I look to a lot for guidance. Mm. She's really one of the people that I see how her ability to share her vulnerability or to acknowledge the meaning of failure and to unlock that kind of, I guess, to be able to look at the joys of failure alongside what might have been tricky about it, has been so instrumental. But it required so much strength from her, and it requires so much strength from other people as well. But it makes such a big difference.
She seems so open to living contradictions, as all of us should be. That,
yeah.
And again, it's back to, you know, choices. There is no right or wrong, and that you can be, even a success can feel not like an unequivocal success, or it can be tinged with failure because you think, well, it didn't happen how I planned for it, or I didn't feel like I thought I'd feel when I got this. I think she talks about that so movingly and gets her guests to talk about it in such a powerful way too.
I absolutely agree, and I just think that her point of strength has emboldened so many other people, and so you can see why she's just so important as this person who can spread that out. But that must take immense strength from her side. There's another book on here that I would say this comes from a real force, is Nimco Ali's book, What We're Told Not to Talk About.
I love Nimco.
If you've ever seen anyone move through the world with so much power, I just think she's so brilliant.
She's got a signed one.
Yeah, I know Nimco a little bit through some charity work, and we occasionally meet and have a nice coffee. But she just, I don't know how she does it, because people are constantly trying to drain her energy away from her, and yet somehow she is able to provide all this energy to all the rest of us. Like, I honestly, whenever I look at what she's doing, I feel invigorated. And she's dealing with such traumatic material, like what she must have to read and see on a daily basis with regards to FGM, I couldn't even fathom. And yet she manages to turn that into strength and power, and her compassion is her strength, and her ability to share her own story and be vulnerable is why she is as strong as she is. And yeah, it's
because I know Nimco a tiny bit from the internet, I think, but just hear her voice and her, like, her liveliness, and to do that, but have such a sort of a spirit and a sense of fun. I've just opened up on a page that said, children are selfish, which is fine. And then the second sentence on the dust jacket is, what does it feel like to have a poo after you've given birth? these are things I want to talk about. These are questions I want to know.
I need to find out.
I was also thinking, while we talk about vulnerability and nurturing, that we have to talk about Everything I Know About Love by Dolly Alderton, which you have two copies of. Dolly will say, friend of the podcast and ours. She was our first ever guest. It feels nice to see her on shelves.
Yeah, I did have to get that second paperback copy because that had the chapter about turning 30. And we're actually, I think I'm close in age to her, or at least I'm close in age by book ages. I had to get that to find out because I had a complete pre-30 panic meltdown as well.
Write about it in a very calm and measured way.
Well, we can all look back with hindsight, can't we? But Dolly's another one where I think the genius is all happening at Dolly's end. You know, to write something as relatable as Everything I Know About Love, to take these really complicated emotions and be able to put them, to talk them through in an entertaining way within stories, but at the end of it you come away thinking, yeah, I felt like that, or I know what that feels like, is actually incredibly hard to do.
And it's such a rare gift to be as dark and sad and moving as she is, but so brilliantly funny. And yes. I suppose it perhaps depends on your your state of mind and when you're reading. Yes. I mean, first of all, I think that a lot of people have gravitated towards that book after a heartbreak. Yeah. And to be properly funny is to do them a great, great, great service. But that, again, it's that the genius of writing something that is such a pleasure to read.
Exactly.
And the weaving of it. But and also just making those brilliantly funny observations where you're like, but of course that's how it feels and how it looks and how it sounds. It couldn't be anything else. And it's entirely original, but it feels so familiar at the same time.
I mean, that's exactly what it is. It's that familiarity while still be just a sensational, unique piece of work. And the other thing is I liked about it is you go on this journey through time with her, and there's the strings that I think we all feel we have where you recognise parts of yourself that just carry on through but are different because of different situations that you go through as you grow up. And equally, her book shows incredible capacity for change, and that in itself is quite inspiring, particularly, I guess, as a young woman. It shows that opportunity of not being stereotyped or not following what necessarily is the traditional path. And it's quite honest in that that might bring some difficulties.
Mm, for sure, that people are so quick to pigeonhole us.
Yes.
And it's what you were saying as well, almost like Ken Follett, to have that, you know, enough of a sense of who you are to write a memoir, but also to be able to see growth and change. But I think you do that in your book. It's hard enough, I think, for any of us to know who we are, but to know who we were and who we might become.
Yes. I found it, it was really interesting because everyone kept telling me how cathartic I would find the writing process.
Oh, that infuriates me. It is bullshit. Writing your book is not therapy. You need therapy when you're writing your book.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. I honestly, revisiting and having to look at yourself at the times where you didn't like yourself and try and be objective about that and share that story in a way that is honest and really reflects what you learned and got out of that situation, as well as how difficult that situation was for you. And there were so many times where I looked back and I didn't recognise myself. I just couldn't understand this woman that I had been, or why I had been the way that I had been. And I found it really quite tricky just having to go through all those events again that at the time I did find difficult, and then having to look through them all again.
You have to watch the horror movie of your own life and you're saying, don't open the door. But I know I did open the door.
Well, I've always said, because you know how people say your life can flash before your eyes, and I just say, please don't let that happen, because I don't want to watch my life. Like, there are so many bits that you wish you could tuck away into dark corners, which is essentially what I had done. I'd put away a lot of the difficult stuff into kind of boxes in my brain, and you have to get it all out again and try and sort through it. And it's not as easy as someone like Dolly makes it seem.
Well, that it's getting, you have to empty out all the boxes, which is hell, and then kind of make them tidy and be able to look at everything and know what fits and what doesn't. My first book, How to Be a Grown-Up, that came out over 3 years ago, and I was writing the proposal 5 years ago, and even now that is there, and there are things that I look at and think, I might have written that differently, or I feel differently. And I wrote it with, you know, lots of love, and I put lots of jokes in, and I wanted it to be something that was uplifting and ultimately useful. But, you know, I think the things I thought I knew then, maybe I didn't know them at all. But that's the hell of, I think, writing any book, isn't it?
How do you feel about the book now? Do you get excited when you see it, or do you? Because at the moment I'm going through, I mean, they're only just being printed, obviously, but I'm like dreading seeing the actual book, and I don't think I'm going to be able to actually, I definitely won't read it. Sorry, that's a terrible way of putting it, but basically it's like that real thing now where I'm almost like, I've done it and I need to put it out there, but I need to step back from it myself.
Yes, that does make sense, because I know, because you have, you know, however many rounds of proofs, and I know that they sort of send a big paper manuscript, and it's interesting having just done it with the novel and it being really uncomfortable, but thinking, actually, I've matured enough to deal with this now, whereas before I was like, I don't think I can go back in. I just was thinking of, I think it's End of Days with Arnie, and the promotional poster is like an explosion behind him and he's just walking away.
Yes,
and that's always been how I feel.
Yeah.
But I think there does come a time when you will feel very tenderly towards it and very, very proud of it. And I think it's normal to not have that now. I went through it, bookshops were very triggering for a while. I didn't like it when they had it. I didn't like it when they didn't have it.
Yes. I guess that's the other thing. You walk in and you immediately take it personally if they don't have your book. You're like, oh, so you chose not to have it in here. What was the reason? When they probably just didn't get their delivery that morning or something.
There's a Marion Keyes story I love called The Other Side of the Story, and it interweaves three stories. And one of the characters is a writer, and her first novel, it's a sleeper hit, and becomes this absolute smash. But when it comes out, they go to the local bookshop and they don't have it anywhere, and they're really sneery when they ask. And you sort of know that must be from Marion Keyes.
Marianne's own experience.
And obviously now, when she has a book out, they fill the window with it.
Yeah, but I mean, they fill everything with
it. I've read that many times. It's cheered me up.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. I absolutely love Marianne Keyes, actually. I think she is fascinating. And she puts so much of herself into her books, which is why I think they're so tender. But my gosh, must that take some... Because I find even if I read fiction... book that touches on things that I myself feel or have experienced, I find that quite, in fact, very upsetting. So the idea of putting those things into something and having to work with that story every day is, I just think that's phenomenal.
When you were talking about Eleanor Oliphant, because that book was just so huge,
yeah,
and I was thinking, did it strike such an enormous chord because so many of us now are using social media in a really addicted way, and it flattens absolutely everything,
yeah.
And it gives us this brief rush of something, but it numbs, and yeah. I really caught myself doing it at points in the pandemic where I'm like, I know I'm here seeking connection and validation in something, and the more I look, the worse I feel, and the less I'm getting.
Yeah, that is so interesting. Actually, there's a really good book, The People Versus Tech by Ooh. Jamie Bartlett, which I would highly recommend for anyone who is interested.
That is a very well-formed bit. I thought it was a proof at first.
I came on a trip with me and I think my bag got soaked. But I absolutely love it and I couldn't be without it. It is such a brilliant book. So much, I mean, there were so many paragraphs in that where there was things that just really hit me, like this idea that now young people are growing up in an age where they kind of have to do this soft censorship of themselves because they're aware that they're always being watched. But then what does that mean for us developing our skills and being able to debate things and exercise moral judgment? Because if you miss out on that learning experience of how that takes place, that's quite a big thing not to have. But yet now we know that if you say like a tweet from 10, like say you did it 10 years ago when you were 16 and you didn't necessarily know all that much about the world, not saying, I mean, I as a 16-year-old knew nothing about the world, but some know huge amounts. But then if you get to 26 and you can still be bound to that version of you because it exists online, and I do worry what that means for people being allowed to feel like they can change and grow when they have this kind of, there's a kind of permanence
yes.
to the version of themselves online. And I think social media is such a double-edged sword because it makes you feel incredibly inadequate a lot of the time, and at the same time it presents you with this solution to that, which is to present your own life as being slightly better than it is.
Well, I do think there are lots of people who might be listening who'd be both profoundly shocked and enormously comforted to think, well, if Camilla feels inadequate on Instagram, then maybe that's the fault of the medium, not the...
Yeah, I think it's also that there has to be some awareness that all of this kind of stuff is tied essentially back to making profit and... historically, making profit has often been related to most of us feeling pretty inadequate nearly all the time.
Oh, that's so true. There's so much money to be made
yes.
from our anger and unhappiness.
Yeah. Yeah, and equally that can come across as, I think people think, oh yeah, but I know what it's like when someone says, oh, you should want this new anti-wrinkle cream or whatever. That seems very obvious. But we forget that actually it's also positive images that can make us feel inadequate. So this kind of fetishization of looking younger and always seeming younger than you are, or, you know, just glamorizing of certain ideals means that the majority of us are going to see that ideal everywhere and feel like we're unable to fulfill it.
Yes, I do think what's the evil genius of social media as well is if you get a magazine and you see an advert and someone looks fabulous, you think, of course they do.
Yes.
That is an advert. My brain knows the difference. Yeah. But when it's celebrities and your friends and adverts and just everything all is one, you have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, that is the other thing. And it's something that I worry about sometimes because, of course, you don't want to share everything on social media, and some things are private and we should all have boundaries that protect ourselves and what we want to deal with amongst just our family and our friends who we are closest to. But that means that only certain aspects of our life will ever reach the online world, and so it's never going to encompass all the difficulties and the struggles. But as a I worry about it now in that if you looked at my Instagram feed, you probably would think I had things pretty good. I do have things pretty good, I should say that. But as in, it maybe belies the fact that there are struggles behind the scenes. And that isn't because I don't want to admit that I do have difficulties in life. It's what I think is appropriate for sharing with a wider world where I don't know the responses I'm going to get. And social media has brought us closer to people who don't necessarily know us well, don't necessarily have our best interests at heart, and those aren't necessarily the people who you want to give you feedback or to comment about immensely personal, difficult struggles, because they don't have the full story. But it does mean that all of our Instagram feeds are going to be different to our real lives. The hardest thing is to remember that everyone else's is different to their real life as well.
Absolutely. So I think I have a lot of freedom online that you don't have, because I know that not that many people are looking at what I'm doing or are interested, and that you have this, the thing that for everyone else, it's purely fun, or it's probably not fun in lots of ways, but different, but the sort of the pressures of almost running it before you run it through any actual filters on the app, the filters in your head of, do I need to think about a million strangers?
Yeah, exactly. That's so funny that you say that, because actually I think not many people realise that now I do have other fears when I share things online. Part of it's to do with knowing that you might potentially have influence and wanting to make sure that is as positive an influence as possible. But also that as individuals, we are all quite contradictory and nuanced, and you know that it's very hard to get things right all the time. And sometimes it's easier not to share anything or to share only the image that is going to get you least horrible criticism. And that's what I think. So, you know, like, for example, say I'll be around a friend's house in those distant days of 2019, not this year, but there might be like a plastic bottle in the background. And I obviously actively in my life tried to reduce my plastic intake, tried to make sure that I restrict it as much as possible. But you might get a really nice picture with a friend that I would love to share. And nowadays, I'll even sometimes be too scared to share that if there's something like that that's just happens to be, it might not even be mine, but knowing how much I will have to explain that and I guess kind of justify it just gives me a real fear. And I think that's, you know, it's easy for me to say, oh, that's what happens when you have lots of followers. But I don't think it's like that. I think it happens at every level. I think people have a real fear of sharing the reality of their lives online because they know it's going to be scrutinised and judged. And so it's happening at every level.
And I'm so curious about who is doing that scrutinising, because I don't, I imagine the people who are quick to say, oh, how dare you have a plastic bottle? Yeah. They're probably, I would be very surprised if those are the people who are sort of regularly, you know, volunteering and donating to environmental charities. But I think it's all part of that flattening, addicted unhappiness, that need to, you know, you feel unhappy and you feel inadequate and you need to take that out, and one feels like one is punching up.
I know, and that speaks to, I think it speaks to a load of different things. First of all, information on these platforms that come from other avenues bar the person, you have to take with a pinch of salt, but people are quite keen to believe things at face value. No, actually, that's wrong to say. I shouldn't say people are keen to believe them at face value. I think they're presented as truths. Mm. And they're presented in a way that sits alongside a lot of other information that is factual, and therefore it's very hard to discern between the two. It's that kind of post-factual era where the sensationalised and the downright fake sits right alongside the very well evidenced and extremely informative. So having those two things in your newsfeed does make people begin to see everything in through that same lens, I guess. It just is very hard to tell the difference. And then the other thing, I guess, is I used to always say I couldn't understand those people who were writing those comments, because I just don't have one single friend who I've ever seen leave that kind of comment on anyone's Instagram. But that is, again, me operating in an echo chamber, and it doesn't take long. I think about how I respond to an email. When I get an email about work when I'm in a bad mood, and how I pick through it and find the real negative points and find the faults in the email and respond in a certain way. And then I think how I respond to that same email on a day where I've had a lot of sleep and I've eaten a good breakfast and I'm feeling great. And I realise that it's two completely different things. And so I have to understand, in a way, it's important for me to try and acknowledge that if I was moving through the world consistently feeling in a difficult place, that when you look at things online, they can feel quite sharply pointed towards you.
Yes.
And you can feel like you are part of something that's not necessarily anything to do with you. And that can manifest in so many different ways. And it is interesting because, like you said, I mean, I get messages every now and again and I'm like, why does that person think that they know enough about me that they can send that message? But isn't that what we're being taught by social media, that we intimately know people that we just don't?
it makes it so easy to give that access to people. On the subject of the downright fake, I want to talk to you about this book, because I love this, and I interviewed Rachel last year when we had events and we went to bookshops. My Friend Anna by Rachel Deloach Williams. Have you read this?
I have, and I find it fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
When that story broke on Vanity Fair, I was obsessed. I even got from New York Magazine, they have their slogan t-shirts. I have a fake German heiress t-shirt.
Gosh, you don't. See, I never saw it when the story initially broke. I heard about this book and I just blew my mind. Completely blew my mind that I could see how someone could create that fake persona. And there were so many little bits in it actually that spoke to me. It's like the bit, you know, when she gets the personal trainer and they're both going to this personal trainer and she's in the full perfect brand new designer sports kit, and then Rachel's wearing like a t-shirt and shorts. And even that spoke to me, because I was thinking about, I went to an exercise class with a friend once. I hadn't realized it was like this kind of influencer class thing. I thought we were just going to an exercise class and everyone was in the most perfect looking sports kit, and I had just not worn the most perfect looking sports kit. I think I pulled it from the bottom of the laundry basket.
Oh God, because 10 years ago, your exercise clothes, they were just the clothes that had retired from being normal clothes.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm going to sleep in this t-shirt or I'm going to run in it.
You suddenly realise how people can have that fake persona, because I was like, yeah, exercise classes now are sometimes more about going and taking the wearing the right stuff, having the right water bottle and taking the right picture than they are about the actual content of it. I mean, there were just so many bits in that I could. Oh, but when she has to pay on her company card, I felt really sick. I love Lem Sisse, My Name Is Why. His poem, I think it's called Invisible Kisses, is one of my absolute favourites. And then that memoir is just, I can't even.
Had you read his poems before reading the memoir?
Yes, I already loved his poetry. I mean, I really do like poetry a lot, so I was excited to read his memoir, but I had to read it in chunks because it is so, so sad. I mean, it's just one of the saddest stories. And how he is the way he is now, I just can't even begin to imagine. But that's what I like, is that you see someone come from that kind of adversity and find strength in it, and also new ways to look at things. Like the way he can look back at his at himself in the past. It was one that I reread actually in the lead up to writing my book, because I think he's very honest about himself when he's younger, but equally he's quite compassionate towards himself as well. And so it, as a book, when you're reading it, you just feel so desperately sad for this horrible system that he is within, and this really just a series of what seems to be such terrible decisions made by other people on his behalf. But equally, you see him as a very genuine, nuanced person. You know, it's, and that's gives the story, that's why it's quite inspirational as well. That's what gives the story its kind of point of, like, you come away from it feeling also quite emboldened.
What about those old ones next to
me? Oh, they were, because they're from, so where my parents live in Scotland, they live near one of the houses that Rabbi Burns used to live in.
Oh, amazing.
When he had his farm, and we went there last year when we went back to Scotland, and they had some old copies of books, and at the time we were thinking, oh, next year we might try and live in a house, and I had like visions of me having this beautiful bookcase filled with old versions, old copies of books, and so I bought those two there, and that's it, those two remain my collection.
The beginning.
One day, I mean, things have slightly not panned out as planned this year either. We'll find them company at some point, but I love, like, I actually, because for a long time when I was travelling with work, it wasn't practical to take books. So I had a Kindle.
Ah.
Other electronic book tablets are available. and as much as I loved it, and I was quite addicted to it at the time, and, you know, I sort of treated it like a friend. I do love having physical copies of books. So quite often, even if I've read something or listened to it on audiobook, I'll still buy a physical copy to have on my shelf. And I do love looking in old bookshops, and I think it's like, I sort of have, I don't know, still some kind of vision of me in like a Notting Hill bookshop, picking up old copies of books.
Would that be the as a buyer, would you have the bookshop?
Oh, maybe. Oh, that's actually a great idea. Owning the bookshop.
You'd be like, you can come and look at my lovely collection of books.
Come and touch my books, but that's it. But yeah, so I know they say don't judge a book by a cover, by its cover, but I do think old book covers are really
that
beautiful.
Copy, the one of the Scottish ones, that 1984. It's a very simple sort of cobalt blue with a white label. It looks very cool. It looks like it could have been. Are they first editions? Or they
no, they're like definitely not first editions. But this one, I know what you mean. This almost looks like it could have been a proof that was sent out back in the world's time, but it wasn't. Oh wait, no, actually, rebound first edition.
Wow,
there we go. But yes, but then I do have a normal copy of 1984 as well, because that one, this is what's bad, buying books for show. The books are for reading, but I definitely bought these two for show. For show. And then my bookshelf's quite, can come across as quite an eclectic mix, because Jamie and I had quite different tastes, and this is obviously a consolidation of the two.
Is there anything that you've lent Jamie and been surprised that he responded to enthusiastically? Has he been able to get him into the novels, other than the Ken Follett?
I mean, the one book that I bought him that he just absolutely loved the same way I loved, which is not fiction, actually, it was School of Life, with the introduction by Alain de Botton. Yeah, we had many a conversation. I mean, it's that thing where you're both setting the worlds to rights, but you both think the same thing. And so we were sat there kind of just agreeing, talking over each other, wanting to say. And actually, all of it comes from Alan's points, but we think we're super intelligent talking about it. Actually, and this book, Bellamy's Jog On, I absolutely loved. So I get quite bad anxiety, which I know you've spoken about as well. And I bought that at the beginning of this year because I was meant to run the London Marathon this year. And two events have obviously come together and made that not possible. But I started reading that because I hate running. I hate running. I hate the time in my own head. I hate the whole process of it, and I'm not good at it, which for me, I'm like one of those people who wants to be good at things, which is just a terrible way of sort of moving through life. But I found that book really, really helpful, and I still found it helpful even though I stopped being able to. I can't run at the moment. Not able to run at the moment because my hips and back. But I just loved how she wrote about it, and maybe running's not the thing for me, but definitely she gave me quite a lot of inspiration that I could have aspects of things in my life that might actually help me in ways I didn't know. So I did love that. Even that thing of, I thought if you went for a run, it had to be at least 5K. I don't know where that came from. I think it's from literally from school, where the minimum distance you were allowed to do for running was like 5K or something. But when I read it and she was like, oh yeah, I ran up the road on the first one and then I came home, and I was like, oh, you're allowed to. It's just so fascinating how I had not. I just hadn't grown up and realised that I could choose
it's
what
like
I was going to do.
Couch to 5K, and yes. That I had to learn, because I don't think I ever did any running at all. Like, oh, and you do it for a minute and you stop and you go again, and that's allowed, and that's yes. How people. Of course, it's how people learn to run. It makes so much sense.
I know. Oh, actually, so I've seen a few people doing that couch to 5K challenge. And at the beginning, I was confused, but like you're saying, I was confused by it. I was like, what do they mean you run for a minute and then walk for a minute? That's, you know, you're meant to put your headphones on and put your house keys in your back pocket, and then you're meant to run gently up the road. And no, you're not meant to do anything. You're meant to do what feels right. But there's something about, she sort of tells that story of how you can learn what's right for you, and you can have agency and ownership over that, and you can start to understand what things make you feel better and help you out generally in life, and you can choose those things for yourself. And that was my kind of takeaway from that, actually. In the end, it didn't have to be running. It was more, I just liked how, yeah, I felt like she was talking from that perspective of liberation and freedom to choose, which I hadn't been good at.
Can be like that for some people too, not always, but yeah, that we forget it's supposed to be fun and pleasure, and it doesn't have to be homework. And I think that sometimes people think, oh, I'm not enjoying this book and I'm finding it quite hard to engage. That means I'm doing it properly, and it's supposed to be. And I think sometimes it's good to be challenged by a book, but also if you only ever read things that just bring you pleasure and joy, then that's up to you.
I so agree with that. And actually, I often think, if something's really hard to read, some things just are hard to read, like War and Peace is going to be, an absolute mission to get through. But sometimes that just means it's possibly not the right thing for you, or it's not been written in a way that is right for you. I think that's why, you know, you get someone like Zadie Smith, who's so readable. And again, it's kind of that thing of genius all happening at her her end. She writes about a multitude of things, fiction and non-fiction, in an intensely readable way. Just because something is dark or complicated or isn't very palatable doesn't mean it always has to be written in a difficult way. And if you're struggling to get through something, you can work. I mean, I choose occasionally to try and work my way through something, but more often than not, I go back to the people whose voices I feel like I can understand. It doesn't have to be about a topic I understand, but I more mean like their writing style. I can find a way to take on the information. And reading should be a pleasure. It's so much of it is about having a way to escape, and it's I think it's quite a constructive way of escaping, because you learn from fiction, from non-fiction. You learn little things about the world, you learn little things about yourself, and you know, we're very lucky that it's something we're able to have access to.
Huge thanks to Camilla. Not the Type is published by Bonnier, and it's a beautiful, powerful and inspiring book about navigating a path through the expectations of others and learning to live on your own terms. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I have been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me. Your Book is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. You can find us on social media at YBooked. Look out for shelfies, suggest some guests, and see what we're reading. I'll see you next time, but for now I leave you with this from Elizabeth Gilbert. If I could read while I was driving, showering, socialising or sleeping, I would do it. See you next time.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.